Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. And in this time of social distancing, watching birds is an activity that you and I can easily do. And we're going to be talking about birds today on the show. Bill Volkert back with us. He's a retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist. Worked at the Horican Marsh for 27 years and has been watching birds for pretty much his whole life. So you may be like Bill and have watched them your whole life, or maybe you're new to birding. What do you want to know about finding birds? Join the conversation. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email or a photo, a bird photo, to ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. And Bill Volkert, welcome back. Great to have you with us again.
Well, thanks, Larry. Appreciate you having me. Sorry we have to do this by phone, but I guess that's our social distancing, about 75 or 80 miles between us.
Well, you know, that's all right. It's working.
Right?
Oh, yeah. Man. You know, and right now, I certainly am, and I know lots of people are probably noticing the birds in their neighborhood a little more these days. You have some advice for new birders?
Well, it's just really gearing up right now for the migration. It always starts slowly, and it can start quite early in the year when the first snow melts, and then it takes a while for spring to get going, and over the next month is when we're really going to be seeing things coming to a peak. So this is a great time to get started. I think for anybody who is somewhat new to birding, I would suggest that you start with the birds in your own backyard and familiarize yourself with those. And don't get too frustrated if, when we see the large wave of birds coming through, that there's a little confusion and some difficulty or challenges trying to sort them out. You don't learn them all in a single year or a single season anyways. Obviously, the best way to learn birds is to go out with somebody experienced, but that's a little more challenging these days. But I've been reading that bird watching seems to be on the uptick during this time of isolation. That's the one thing that people can do. And I think there's probably a few reasons for it. Not only are we limited by the number of activities that we can undertake, but I think people are also suffering from cabin fever compounded with this isolation. And the bird watching and just anything outdoors is something we can easily do. It breaks up the day a bit, gets you some fresh air, which is always healthy. And to go out and look at birds and in a time when things seem a little depressing or a little gloomy, there's some new life coming in, and I think it helps to cheer us up a little bit. So it's good for the mind and good for, you know, for yourself just to get some fresh air and get outside and change the scenery.
Yeah, absolutely. What are some good online resources for identifying birds?
Well, they're developing more and more of these all the time, but for a good, easy reference, the Cornell site has become very comprehensive. All About Birds is a real nice one. You can just search under All About Birds, and you can type in any bird you want. There's some basic identification of it. It's like an online field guide, and you can play the songs. Those are nice. Another one, which is sort of a takeoff from that, is Merlin. And Merlin is the name of one of our falcons. Merlin, they now have online field guides. You can load them down to your phone, and they're trying to develop them for more and more places around the world. We got back from leading a tour to Nicaragua again just before the pandemic really got going, and I was able to download Merlin for Nicaragua, and there you are with the birds online. The songs are there, and that's all pretty handy, and you can do that for Wisconsin and the Midwest. So those are some really good resources for yourself.
Well, we already have a number of people online who want to visit with you by phone here, Bill. So maybe let's take a few calls. Jim in Elm Grove. Yeah, you're up first. Hi, Jim. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. Hi, Larry. I have a question. We saw a couple birds chasing each other in the front yard this morning, and they hit the window on the car, and one of them was injured and laying on the ground. And just was curious, when that kind of thing happens, what are you supposed to do to help it? We went over, we put some gloves on, kind of stroked the back of it a little bit. It kind of woke up a bit, and then we made a little nest for it, and it's been hopping around. But what do you do? So I think it might recover on its own, but what do you kind of do when you have a situation like that? I can listen off the phone. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Jim.
Very good question. And window strikes is becoming an increasing concern for scientists and bird watchers. We know that glass is certainly a hazard because it's something that birds just are not familiar with. It's not natural. And whether this is a little unusual on a vehicle, I think it's more the house. And what we find is it's really two things that happen. One is they either see reflection of shrubbery in trees and think it's a place to fly into and hide, or perhaps they can see through from one window to the next and figure, well, here's an opening. I can just duck through that. And when birds strike glass, they can sometimes be knocked somewhat semi-unconscious, or it'll break their necks immediately. The problem is, even when they seem to recover and release them, we don't know to what degree there may be more serious internal injuries. The best thing you can do, however, if you should find a bird in that condition, is I take a paper bag or a box, put it in there for a little while. Paper bags work nice. They're usually pretty handy. You close it up, and the main thing is you're creating darkness. That calms the bird down. They're not frightened by your presence. It seems to them it's more like getting toward twilight or dark, so they start to relax, which is what they need. And in a paper bag, you can also hear when they start to become a little more active and start rustling around in there. If they do that, it's time to let them go, and you can just cross your fingers and hope that they didn't suffer too serious of an injury. The other thing I would strongly suggest, though, if anybody is finding window strikes around their house, try to do something to minimize it. Obviously, that prevention is going to be way ahead of the game. We did that at our house. We've got trees and shrubs around here, and on average, I had a bird strike our windows about once every month or two, and it was getting to be a point of, 6, 10, maybe a dozen a year. It may not sound like a lot, but it's always a little shocking for us when you sit in the house and you hear that loud thump and you hope something didn't kill itself, and you never know how well they're going to recover. So we found a nice product. It's actually made in Wisconsin. This is a Kaleidoscape, from Jeansville. And they make either whole sheets that go over a window, which to me I found difficult to look through, but we had them cut them in half-inch strips. And any sort of a barrier on a window that is 4 inches apart or less, birds seem to look at that as too narrow to fly between. So we just put strips of this material on the windows, and we have reduced our bird window strikes and collisions to absolutely zero. I have had nothing hit the windows where we have those. Now, I'll admit, the first few times that somebody comes to the house, they may look at that and go, what's that on the windows? Looks like jail bars. But, within a month's time, we don't even notice it anymore. And, it may not be the most aesthetic to have these little stripes on your window, but the fact that we're saving birds' lives is a huge improvement for us, especially since we're gardening for wildlife around the house. You don't want to lure them in and then have them strike your windows. And if you think about it, it's not just what I've done, but how many hundreds of thousands of residential homes do we have, particularly those in more suburban areas with larger yards and foliage around, the vegetation that attracts birds. I think we can make a huge difference in the survivorship of birds and make our houses a little more bird-friendly that way, and also by doing good landscaping to make a little more of a birdscape within our own backyard to make it attractive to them.
And our caller was talking about the one bird chasing the other, and I've noticed quite a bit of that activity.
That time of year.
Poor female sparrow with five males after her chasing around.
And what you really have are two things. Yes, the females are, and this is typical, by the way, of most birds. The males arrive first, try to establish the territory, then shortly thereafter the females come. So the males may be chasing other competitors as other males to keep them out of their area, or once the females arrive, there's also that competition for a mate. So you have both things going on. And you'll see, for example, one of the common aerial displays among red-winged blackbirds is males will chase females and are trying to show their vigor and ability and keep her within that territory. And if any other male comes nearby, they'll be very aggressively driving them out. So those are those chases between two competing males or males trying to lure a female as a mate.
Let's take another call. Lois in DeForest, it's your turn. Hi, Lois.
Hi, I'm so happy to have the DNR biologist, Dan. I'm sorry.
Bill, yeah.
You helped me so much. I'll never forget how you told me that is always so very good, the type of bird feeder to buy so that the bird isn't collecting anything that would provide conjunctivitis to the bird.
Sure. Yep.
You thank you for that. But I wanted to offer that I do have little decorations on my window to avoid bird strikes, and I bought them at Bruce's in Middleton, and they have been on my window for years. They're put on the outside of the window, and they're leaf designs, and you can look at they're almost invisible. So they're a see-through type of material, and they stick on the window. And as I said, I've had them on there for years, and they stay.
Well, those are some of the newer designs that the engineers are working on, is something that's quite visible to birds from the outside, but is not so much of a distraction or annoyance for people on the inside looking out of the window. Originally, some of the early designs were the hawk or falcon silhouettes that people would put on the windows. But it turned out that birds really don't recognize that silhouette so well. It certainly didn't keep them away from the house. And as you plaster just stickers and things on your window, occasionally there may be bird strikes with that, because the important thing is you have to have them close enough for spaces less than 4 inches apart. If there's just two or three of them on a large window, the birds may still see what appears to them to be an opening, which can result in, again, a window strike. I should also mention, for others, you talked about conjunctivitis. This is a bacterial disease that spread particularly among finches, house finches, and occasionally goldfinches. And the tube feeders, it's oftentimes when they're reaching in to get that small Niger seed, that the so-called eyelashes of the bird, the modified feathers around the eye, will pick up that bacteria, and it leads to an infection, and can be like a blindness and swelling around the eye. And that can be spread from feeder to feeder. So there are some new feeder designs out there that reduce that, the way the birds feed. And with any bird feeder, it's always important to periodically, when you refill them, take them down, clean them out, put them in warm water and bleach just to disinfect, because birds can spread bacteria, and it's the last thing we want is to have an infection around our feeding stations.
Absolutely. Lois, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Bill Volkert, our guest today, retired wildlife educator and naturalist, worked at Horicon Marsh for 27 years. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer today. Tim Peterson, our on-air producer, Tyler Ditter, our engineer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at early spring migration on the show today, I'm Larry Mueller with my guest, Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator. Great to have you listening in. You can join in with your own questions or comments at 800-642-1234. Email your photos, bird photos, or your questions to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Mary in the Dunnville Wildlife Area up next with a comment. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I just have a comment that our beloved vultures are in mass, and I'm seeing less birds than I normally see at this time. Eagles are fighting for territory here, and quite a few cranes landed just in my backyard. So things are moving. They're moving slow.
All right. Mary, thanks very much for calling. Well, there's some birds that that are here early and often.
Are back. They're actually a fairly early migrant. They may arrive here in late February or certainly in the first couple of weeks of March. As that snow starts to melt, even with that bald head, they seem to be able to tolerate the cold nights. But I think there's a lot of fresh frozen food out there. In other words, mammals that have died over the winter time that are being thawed out, whether that's roadkill or natural deaths. There's a lot to be cleaned up, and vultures are certainly the cleanup crew. So they're back. Sandhill cranes, they return about the time that the snow melts and the wetlands begin to thaw. And right now, a lot of the waterfowl are coming in. So we always see this progression of birds in the season responding to availability of food. And, of course, they all have different diets. So the first arrivals are always the upland feeders, the Canada geese and red-winged blackbirds. They wait for the snow to melt. Takes a little longer for the ice to melt. The waterfowl are in now. And it'll be a while yet before we really start seeing the insect hatches, which are the primary food for songbirds. So we're just gearing up with that early migration. And as Mary said, I'm just starting to see a few birds. And I'm hearing reports right now. Not a lot of people are seeing them, but the first few of the brown thrashers are showing up. I just read this morning someone seeing in southern Wisconsin the first towhee. I had chipping sparrow this morning. They're showing up in a few more places. So we're just getting going in the next 2 weeks. I expect that white-throated sparrows will be coming north in big numbers. And as we get to the end of April, we'll see the first of the songbirds. And then the first 2-3 weeks of May is really the peak of the songbird migration. So we can expect our summer birds to be back at that time.
Seth and Katie emailed that birding is getting them through this stressful time. He says that we're working from home in Maple Plain, Wisconsin. In the past week, we've seen cranes, swans, robins, phoebes, wood ducks, geese, eagles, a bluebird, and, of course, a red-winged blackbirds and ravens are there in force. Still no herons. Yeah. Yesterday, I pulled into the boat landing on nearby Horseshoe Lake and was surprised to see two loons so close to me. I just heard them calling the other night. And at the same time as the first peeper frogs of the year, you don't expect to get such a good view. And he has a nice photo that he sent of the loons.
Oh, nice. Loons, of course, are common nesting across northern Wisconsin, primarily that northern third. They are starting to expand their range a little bit south in central Wisconsin. And, of course, quite a bit of Canada is the main nesting range. But at this time of year, any of the large lakes all throughout southern Wisconsin should have loons sitting on them as they're making their way north. And especially some of the birds that are heading to the Canadian breeding grounds, there's still ice on those lakes. So they're hanging out here and having their success fishing. So this is a good time to just go out to any of the larger lakes and just scan them and watch for loons sitting out there. And the people in northern Wisconsin will enjoy them throughout the summer on the nesting grounds.
Yeah, for sure. Nancy in Chautauqua emailed that she thought she saw some loons on the lake. She counted 40. They were black and white, big, longish bills. They looked low in the water. Was she looking at mergansers, perhaps?
That's a possibility. Loons will occasionally congregate, but they're not a flocking bird. They're more solitary. Occasionally, you'll see a number of them gather together as they're making their way north and find a good lake. And we've even had reports off the Madison Lakes in late fall where there may be 20, 30 of them. But I think those are scattered across a pretty big area. If you've got them flocking together a little more tightly, I would expect that those are the mergansers, especially common merganser, which at a distance could be mistaken for a loon. But the body is pure white with that dark green head and a red bill. Closer up, you'll see that it's a very narrow, thin bill, and they've got just a little bit of a crest, a little scruff on top of the head. So where the loon has that checkered ring around the neck, and they tend to me, look a little more chunky, a little heavier head, heavier body, and they sit lower in the water because they're such expert divers.
Yeah, that's a really good description. Dave in Broadhead has something for us. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Larry. Hey, I have a question. I don't know whether you have any numbers from the, like, winter bird count, that type of thing, but I just noticed this year we've seen almost no goldfinches. In fact, we haven't seen any goldfinches, and we normally have lots of them, and we've seen no nuthatches. And normally I don't think they migrate. I mean, maybe this year did they migrate further south because of the winter, but I'm just curious if you have any information on why we wouldn't be seeing any of them.
Do you mean white-breasted or red-breasted nuthatch?
White-breasted nuthatches.
Okay. White-breasted nuthatch is a permanent resident So those are birds that will stay around in Wisconsin throughout the year. And maybe there's a little shift of the local population or something there that a pair or two may have disappeared in your neighborhood. But normally they occur throughout the year. Red-breasted nuthatches will migrate, so we'll see them coming and going across Wisconsin in the fall. And about this time of year, we'll start seeing them making their way back north again. So those numbers can vary a little bit. But I would expect a white-breasted nuthatch. It's probably more of a local phenomenon. When you mentioned about the finches, this was a very poor finch year. And the reason for that is the abundant cone crop in Canada. There was lots of natural food. So those birds were not compelled to come south. And, yes, even goldfinches seem to be a little more sparse. And these birds are nomads. They move around during the wintertime to wherever that food production is, wherever you had whatever they're feeding on. The different finches will take different size seed. But, yeah, they can move quite a bit. And as you look at the larger continental counts, you can actually see shifts of east-west or birds remaining north, or in years of very poor cone production in Canada, these eruptions or invasions of these birds coming south. So that's pretty irregular. People who are looking for even purple finches this year were fairly sparse across much of Wisconsin. Pine siskins, almost non-existent. Very, very few red poles came down in the winter. It was just so much food up north, they weren't compelled to come our way.
Mm-hmm. All right, Dave. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling, Dave. Appreciate it. Rich in Two Rivers, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Rich.
Hello, Larry. I got two comments, and the first one is I want to give kudos to the Horticultural Center. It's an amazing place. It's free, and you can go through the museum and learn a lot, and you can also take the walking path through the marshes. And then my second comment was I was sitting at the computer, and a bird kept coming from the garage and the breezeway and hitting the pane of glass over and over and over again. And it did it for like 3 days. And I didn't know what to do. So I put a picture of my ex-wife up there, and it never showed up again.
I don't know if the selection of the picture had anything to do with it. I won't comment on that. What you're seeing, and let me just ask, was this a robin, a goldfinch, or a cardinal? Any one of those three? Those are the most common ones to be pecking at the windows.
It was a nasty blue jay.
Nasty blue jay.
Okay. Blue jay is a little bit unusual to do that, but what you're really seeing is what I call shadow boxing. Birds now are getting into that breeding season, and as we talked earlier, they're trying to drive other competing males out of their territory. Well, glass is not only a hazard to fly into, but the reflections, they can oftentimes see themselves. And, the birds will chase after that. And sometimes it gets to be almost a neurotic behavior and very compulsive with these birds. They will be at that for days and days, which can be to the annoyance of the residents, not to mention it's a waste of energy for the bird. The best thing you can do is try to break them of that habit early, before they even get going. Put up some sort of a barrier, a distraction or something, whatever you need to break that bird before he gets going. The problem is they may start tapping and fluttering up against one window. You may put streamers or something up to distract them. You'll just go around the corner of the house. But they're seeing themselves. And if you can imagine from the bird's point of view, he looks at the glass. Oh, my gosh, there's a competitor. Let me chase and fly and flutter at him and chase him out of the neighborhood. Turns around. Hey, I got rid of him. And he looks over your shoulder, and there he's back again. They'll do that for residential houses, and also mirrors on vehicles is another one where birds will see themselves and, of course, leave a lot of droppings along on that windowsill or on the side of the car. A lot of the mirrors on vehicles you can fold in, something you may want to do if you got them doing that. Helps to break the habit. But that's the best you can do is try to discourage them right from the start before they even get a bad compulsive habit going.
Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Oh, man. Nick in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Nick.
Oh, this is going to be really hilarious because my kids are in the back and they think it's just hilarious. But I put up like 5-10 bird feeders. I love my birds until this morning. I was in the garage working, and this dang robin, I don't know if it's just watching me and just waiting for me, but I've been hit in the head 3 times. Yeah, it's funny, guys. Anyways, how do I get this bird to go away? I mean, it's like she's just like waiting for me to get in the garage, and then she just hits me in the head. Yeah, that's so funny for
her. Is she starting a nest right there, maybe on top of a light or an eave or somewhere? That's the most typical thing. Robins will make a nest with a mud foundation, and the grass is a weaver on the upper part of it. So they're looking for something to plaster that nest on. A fork in a tree, very common. The light next to the front door, something like that. And if she's chosen that as a nesting space, yeah, she doesn't want to have any disturbance around. And I've heard from people many times in the past, robinets nesting right on the porch light at the front door. And every time they go in and out of the house or someone comes to visit, the bird is not only leaving a mess there, but attacking everyone. According to the federal laws, you cannot destroy the nests of birds once they've actually begun to lay their eggs. What I would suggest, this is very early in the nesting. If she's just beginning to build that nest, you may want to remove the foundation of that structure, put something there so she can't easily build again. In other words, compel her to build that somewhere else at a little bit of a distance. And unfortunately, those porch lights and little perches like that make a very attractive area for a bird, especially if you have a little bit of an awning over the top or your soffit. It gives them good protection from the weather, so they just love that. It's just inconvenient for us.
So there you go, Nick. I'm glad your kids are having fun with you about it, though. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Yeah, see, we can just turn that bird early on in this before she gets going. Because they raise more than one brood, by the way. And you may have a bird like that with that annoyance for the next couple of months. So,
yeah. There you go. Jan in Viroqua, your turn. Hi, Jan.
Hi, guys. I would like to attract the widest range of birds to my backyard, to my feeder.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering what kinds of foods I should put out and what configurations of feeders, and any cautions that you might have to people who want to feed the wild birds.
Thanks. Oh, sure. Very good questions. Yes, thanks for asking. A couple of suggestions. First of all, if you want a variety of birds, a variety of food. If you just take a look, birds come in different sizes and also different shapes of beaks. Well, that's for extracting different kinds of food. So the heavier beaks that you're going to see of the cardinal and the finches are for cracking the larger seeds. The very tiny seeds of the Niger is something that the finches are more attracted to. So you want to have a variety of food, your mixed seed, your Niger seed, maybe some suet for the woodpeckers and nuthatches. But then remember the fundamentals of good habitat. Just as in nature, it applies to your backyard. Every animal needs food, water, and shelter. And by putting up a lot of feeders in a vacant, open backyard with no trees and shrubs or any safe perches and hiding places for birds, it's hard to attract them. So here's a suggestion I have for people right now. We're very early in the season yet. It's a time we're just gearing up, not just to watch birds and watch the migration, but also for our gardening. This is a perfect time to plan your landscaping, to do something to make your backyard more bird-friendly, add some shrubs, a conifer, a butterfly garden, something like that that'll make it more attractive, not only as natural food, but also as safe places for them to hide in during the weather, to escape from predators, and maybe even to nest. Birds want safety out there, so a landscape around those feeders too.
Very good advice. And Jan, thanks again for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, let's go to Wayne in Green Bay next. Hi, Wayne.
Well, good morning. Good morning. I love your show. I bike, and I appreciated the one yesterday, and I appreciate the canoeing one in the past. I talked before, and this is great. I'm going to have to try that ex-wife picture in the window thing. That might work. I have a big patio window. That might work. But I called about the bald eagles. I drive for a medical transportation company in Green Bay, and we drive all over town during this time of coronavirus and stuff. And I've noticed a lot of eagles this year. I saw 7 in one spot in the Fox River where the ice was just coming off, and they were picking in there. And for like 2 days, they were all congregated there. It was amazing. And I drive by on Riverside Drive, and they were all cluttered up in there. It was great. And then they went away, and I saw a few here and there because they fly around. And then I noticed two more bald eagles when I crossed the Tower Drive Bridge, and in those little ponds by the gas station stuff, or where they have those gas tanks and the water all the way around them, I noticed some eagles down in there too, and in the trees. And I counted 35, and they were picking fish and whatever else out of the frozen ice.
Wow.
And it was absolutely amazing. 35. And I've never seen that before, but when I was a kid, I'd go paddling up north, and we'd see an eagle, and it was a big to-do. We'd come back, and we're like, oh, we saw an eagle. Now I go to work, and I see 35. It's like, that's awesome.
That is awesome, Wayne.
Yeah, great experience. And, you know, I think he echoes what I've been hearing from a lot of people. Anyone who's been around for a while will remember, you know, years ago, you had to travel in northern Wisconsin to find an eagle, and if you did, it was a lucky sighting. Now it's very commonplace. Our nesting population is over 1,500 pair just in Wisconsin, and they're no longer isolated just to the northern lake country. They're in almost every county of the state. There are eagles that are nesting, and as he had just mentioned about the concentrations, well, we're at a point now where the lakes in southern Wisconsin are open and that ice is slowly refeeding. Well, they're looking for good fishing places. And was mentioned on the Fox River, there was just some open water. Well, they're limited hunting opportunities, so they were really concentrated there at this time. And as more and more of that ice recedes, there's going to be much more available fishing areas, and the birds will spread out, and they'll also continue to settle in on the nesting grounds. But, yeah, bald eagles are no longer a rare sight. They're always spectacular. I would certainly not diminish the sighting of an eagle as much commonplace as it's becoming these days. But it is something that people can enjoy in almost any corner of the state these days. So a wonderful recovery of a bird population, and a very majestic bird at that.
And, Wayne, good for you. And, boy, seeing 35 in one spot, that's amazing.
Yeah, very nice.
That's amazing. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it very much. Judy in Racine has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Judy.
Hi. Always look forward to your visits, Bill. And this isn't amazing. I just have kind of a funny question. We've had a small flock of juncos visiting our backyard feeders all winter long, and they've been around, and I thought, aren't you guys going to leave one of these days? And I thought it was kind of late. And then while I was waiting, I did notice one lonesome one out there. So I don't know.
Yeah, we did. Last night, well, we had that warm weather, especially in southern Wisconsin, yesterday. And then the wind shifted, and it was a very light northerly wind, which is not good for migration conditions. But usually as we get to about mid-April, that second, third week is when, for southern Wisconsin, we see the departure of the juncos. So they've been singing now for the last few weeks. They're starting to become a little more active, a little more vocal. And I walked around this morning, and I'm seeing less juncos even around my backyard. Was it calm enough last night that they started to advance? Oh, there's one right out the window at this point. They didn't all take off, but I would say within the next 10 days, we should see a mass departure of the juncos leaving southern Wisconsin, and at the same time, other birds coming in as that migration moves on. Keep in mind that the majority of our songbirds migrate at night. And this is a trick that all the bird watchers know about, is watch the weather report and watch what the weatherman says about the wind conditions overnight. If we have a nice warm wind, a nice warm front with winds out of the south, southwest, I don't mean gusty, strong, stormy winds, but a nice steady wind, 5, 10, 15 miles an hour, the birds are riding that. And you get up the next morning and something new has appeared. And at the same time, some of these winter birds will have exited from here. So this is the time of transition, and it's going to change every couple of days as those weather systems come and go.
And thanks again, Judy, for calling. I want to give Jeff in the Flambeau Flowage area a chance to join in. Hi, Jeff.
Hello, Larry. Say, I just wanted to announce that I just finished reading Somner Madison's new book called A Field, and the chapter on Bill Volkart is absolutely fascinating. I've known Bill for over 30 years, and I never realized what a wild and crazy guy he was. And the evolution of him as a boy in Milwaukee to being one of the best naturalists in the state is absolutely a fascinating read. And I encourage everybody to take a look at that. It even includes his history of the Larry Mueller Show. And I'd encourage you, Larry, that when you get a chance, you ought to do a show with Sommer and interview him about the book. But anyway, a great read, a fascinating man, that Bill. Just wanted to pass that on.
Oh, well, Bill, have you read the chapter?
Well, yeah, I worked with Sumner on that, and I have my ambivalent feelings. I'm glad to hear that kind of feedback. I'm flattered by it, and I have some real mixed feelings on it. I talked to Sumner at length. I said, you know, when he first asked me, I was very much flattered about it, that he would even ask. On the other hand, I feel a little apprehensive to have my personal life out in the public so much. As I told Sumner, I said, you know, in the past when people asked me, I could always filter what I did and didn't want to say. It's in print now. Oh, well, story's out there. But, yeah, take it for what it's worth. You know, that's what I do with my time.
Well, I tell you what, and what a better place to be. Here's Jeff sitting on the flambeau flowage reading a book by Sumner Madison titled A Field. Boy.
Sumner's been a good friend of mine for many, many years. He's an incredible avian ecologist. His contributions to Wisconsin birds and bird conservation has been just a long list and very extraordinary. And for that, a long list of work. He's also being recognized this year with special honors from the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology for his contributions to bird conservation in Wisconsin.
I'll have to get him on the show and talk with him about his book, and we'll go into more detail about your sordid past. Oh, just kidding there about the sordid past.
I don't know if that's quite the way I describe it, but...
Oh, man. Well, let's move on. Let's go to Brian in Portage. Hi, Brian.
Good morning. Hey, I've got a question about birds nesting. I run a, one of those self-propelled sprayers, and when I bring it out in the spring and get it ready and park it in the yard, and probably, I know for the last 10 years, there's a robin's nest built in exactly the same place underneath the sprayer, and every time I go to start the season, there's this robin's nest, and it's the same place. How long do they live, or do their other family members take over for them?
Interesting.
Really
thanks,
question.
Brian.
Yeah, and I've had this from people over the years. They say, you know, I've been living at this house for 20 years, and every year there's that same bird nesting in that tree. Well, on average, from the studies that we've done on songbirds, larger birds can live much longer, but average life for songbirds is about 3 to 5 years. Now, we do have records of robins and some of the other songbirds living to 8, 10, even 12 years. So, yeah, you know, birds can live a decade, but, you know, for a robin to live to 10, 12 years is kind of like one of us living over 100. It can happen, and it does, but not that often. So, yeah, there's normally a turnover rate of about, say, 3 to 5 years or so. Maybe it's just more an attractive area that a different bird has just come back and found that same territory and a suitable site to build a nest. Or perhaps he's got a bird that's lived that long. The only way to really know that is through bird banding. So when scientists actually capture birds and mark them with the aluminum leg band is the most common type of thing that we put on them, there we can identify individuals, and so we know who's who. The problem is for casual observation, we can identify all the different kinds of birds in our backyard and see the variety that comes, but every robin in the world looks alike, so we really can't figure out which individuals coming back each year and for how long they live without somehow actually marking that bird and following it through its life.
Brian, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Taking a look at early spring migration today. Bill Volkert, our guest, retired wildlife educator and naturalist, worked at Horicon Marsh for 27 years. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at early spring migration on the show today, Larry Mueller here with my guest, Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator and naturalist. Thanks for joining in. Our lines are all filled. The number is 800-642-1234. You could also email us a photo and question at ideas@wpr.org. We would love to hear from you. And as I said, we have lots of callers online, so I think it'd be worth it to go back to the phones. Bill, let's talk to Dennis in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Of course, when we have lights on at night, those attract insects. So I wonder, do the lights attracting insects, does that make it easier for birds and bats to get insects, or would the bats and the birds shy away from the light?
I would think it probably doesn't make an awful lot of difference. Now, for a bat, it may, because you're actually not just attracting, but maybe concentrating some insects. So perhaps if there's one in the area, maybe it's some easy pickings. But remember, most of our birds are feeding during the daytime. So the insects that you attract at nighttime, you're not going to be attracting the birds at that same time either. So for birds, it's completely negligible. They're not going to be active at that time.
All right, there we go. Let's go to Rod in Arlington next, then. Hi, Rod.
Hey, how you doing today? Thanks for taking my call. I had a question about wood ducks. Last year, we had a big arm of a tree come down, and as I was cleaning it up, I started popping some fuzz out of it, and I went, nah, something's not right, and it was hollowed. So I cut it open, and I found a bunch, about 14 wood duck eggs. About a week later, I figured, that was the end of that. About a week later, here's a mama wood duck leading off 7 down towards the marsh very near our house. And this spring now, in the last week and a half, I have seen and heard a duck fly from one of the trees in the front yard again. Do they return to the same area, or could this be one of the young ones from last year coming back to where they got hatched from?
Well, actually, it could be either of the cases. Wood ducks probably true as it is for many of the other waterfowl. They will return back to their nesting ground, and particularly they tend to return very close to the site where they nested the previous year if they were successful. So if they found a place that worked for them last year, they'll try again this year as well. And for ducks, they mature within that first year, so the young from last year may be coming back just as well to their natal ground and now beginning the nest. So, yes, it could be either one of the adults returning or one of the young from previous years.
And we have some sound on wood ducks. Tyler, have you got the wood duck calls up there? Yeah, he's trying to set it up.
Yeah, it's a high kind of a whistle or almost a squeaking type sound. So it does not sound like a duck when we think of the quacking like a mallard. It's a very distinctive high whistled song call that they make. And usually in flight. There.
That's really interesting. It's totally different than what you might, kind of expect, let's say.
Right. Yeah, the mallard is the most common one, and that's, I think, also the one that's used most often when we think of ducks, that quacking sound. Even as kids, it's the first thing we recognize as far as the sound that a duck makes. And hear that high, thin whistle of a wood duck is pretty uncharacteristic. When the pairs are on the water and displaying, they may make that call. And certainly that's also what they give in flight. And right now you'll see males and females, they're chasing each other around. And the female tends to come back to where she nested. They pair up and start to actually select mates on the wintering ground. So she may be coming back with someone that's been trying to attract her and display on the wintering grounds already and making her way north. And it's not unusual to see a hen being chased by two or even three males that are at least prospecting for potential mate. So right now there's a lot of that chasing and flying around, and you'll hear them whistling as they're flying overhead and trying to settle in. Now, some of the wood ducks already have laid eggs. I heard a few reports from people who say that they've checked their boxes within the last week and the first few eggs have already been laid. Other birds, especially young from last year, may take a little longer before they actually find a mate, a suitable area, and then begin to settle down and start the nest. So the the egg-laying period can start anywhere from now in mid-April and may go over the next month, where we may see some of the late nesters actually initiate. And then we may even have birds that lost the nest that will try a second time.
And those eggs, from the time they're laid, how many days go by before they hatch?
About 18 to 21 days, if I recall off the top of my head. Right about there is average. Mallard is 21 days, just like a chicken. Canada goose, 28 to 29 days. For most birds, the larger the bird and the bigger the egg, the longer the incubation period. And you also have two different strategies where ducks and geese, the young, hatch out fully feathered and walk away right within that first 24 hours. Songbirds, of course, the young hatch out essentially prematurely. They're naked, blind, and then have to be raised in the nest before they can fledge. Then those eggs like that will hatch out a little bit faster compared to the body size of the bird.
Let's take another call. Joe in Eagle River, it's your turn. Hi, Joe.
Hi there. I had a question about song sparrows. We had the pleasure of having a pair nest last year, but unfortunately they picked a large daylily clump that was being protected by my wife's deer netting, and it was great until the young started to fledge. And while we were gone that weekend, several of them got caught in the netting and then expired before they could leave. So wondering about a better way to attract the nest to a place that was out of harm's way. Will they nest in a certain type of a box nest, or do they like the ground, or what suggestions would you have? We live on a lake and a lot of trees around, and we also just found one in a peony bush when my wife was trimming it back to get it ready.
Interesting. Bill, what do you think?
Yeah. The sparrow family, our North American sparrows in Wisconsin, we have 19 different species. A lot of them are associated with grasslands. Those birds nest on the ground. Song sparrows, they like the thickets, so it's the shrubbery. So you mentioned peonies bush or some dense shrubbery is usually the selected site for them. They do not use bird houses. So bird boxes, bird houses, those are not going to attract the song sparrow, and as we mentioned earlier, landscaping in your backyard. It's not just shelter, but that's nesting spaces for those birds. Song sparrow, we will have a few that overwinter in Wisconsin, but we're just a little far north, but they are a pretty early arrival in springtime. They've been here for almost 3 weeks now. So they come as soon as that snow melts. They're one of the earlier migrants to arrive back, and they've been singing away for quite some time now.
Maria in Lake Geneva, we'll turn to you. Hi, Maria.
Hi, Larry. What a wonderful show. Thank you so much. I just want to say we see loons on Geneva Lake here. And also, this is the first time we've lived in this house for over 30 years, and we have a mourning dove making a nest on our windowsill. And that's been fun to watch.
Oh, so you can just watch the nest making and everything.
Yeah. Yes, and I have a window box. I thought, oh, it's going to make its nest in the window box. No, it's on the ledge. Yeah, the nest is just like little tiny twigs. It's not like a robin's nest. It's circular and, straw and things like that. It's kind of funny.
No, they do not go out of their way to make much of a nest structure. They crisscross a couple of branches, and that's good enough for them as long as it can hold the eggs. So it's not that full cup, and there's not a lot of engineering that goes into a mourning dove nest. Very commonly, they are so loosely laid out that if you look from underneath, you can see the eggs through it. And it even happened where sometimes the eggs will just roll off of the nest. They don't make a really complex structure. Mourning doves can nest quite early in the year, so they may be starting now already as we get to that latter part of April. And we'll have multiple broods, usually one to two eggs, most commonly two eggs. And in Wisconsin, they may easily raise two, sometimes three broods in a summer season. In the southern states, they may have as many as five broods, starting very early in the year and continuing well into the fall season.
Wow. Maria, thanks so much. Loved your call. Yes. Appreciate it very much. Well, we have Gary in Ween. Gary, hello.
Morning, Larry. Great show as always. Had our first gold since yesterday. The reason I called was I wanted you guys to give a little acknowledgement to Rachel Carson and her Silent Spring book from 1962. Without that, we would not be celebrating all the eagles and the other bird species that have come back, and that we need to be reminded that protecting the environment is a perpetual job, and we can't become complacent, and we need to use the best science available.
Well, thank you very much, Gary, for calling.
Yeah, appreciate that.
Bill, a quick comment?
Yeah, well, Silent Spring certainly was a tremendous breakthrough, calling attention to pesticides, particularly DDT, and its impact on songbirds, and especially the eagles, ospreys, and some other birds of prey. We have banned DDT, but the problem has morphed now, where now we have the neonicotinoids, which seem to have some impacts on weight gain for birds, and certainly maybe one of the impacts for the tremendous decline of our insects, which is food for those birds. And
yeah.
We heard earlier this summer, this past summer, there was a report that looking at the data of North American birds, bird populations of all kinds across U.S. and Canada, we've lost a quarter of the number of birds within the last 40 years.
We're going to have to take a quick break, Bill. Hold on to that thought. We can come back to that. Bill Volkert, our guest today. I'm Larry Mealer. He will be with us right up till 12:30. Look at the news, and then we'll be back. Stay with us. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mealer here. We're talking about birds and birding with Bill Volkert today. Bill, a retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist, also a federally licensed master bird bander with the Bird Banding Laboratory of the U.S. Geological Survey. And he has, I personally identified, over 3,900 bird species. So amazing. Questions about birds today? I hope you'll join in. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. And we have an open line or two and get you on pretty quick. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. You can also send photos that way as well. Callers online, Bill, so I think we'll go right back to the phones and to Mary.
Sounds
in La Crosse.
Sure.
Yeah. Mary in La Crosse, your turn.
Hi. Well, your program came on at a good time because just last week, my bird friend and I were talking about the birds we're watching, and she said, why in the world do birds like suet? Because it doesn't seem it exists in nature unless it's would be a dead animal or something, but I can't see a woodpecker picking on a dead animal. And so how did suet became known to be a bird food? And golly, it's certainly popular, and I love my woodpeckers on my suet.
Well, interesting question. I actually do know of a few people who will take the rib cage of a deer carcass and hang that in a tree. It's not much of a lawn ornament. but the birds will peck at that, and as was mentioned, perhaps from a carcass might be one place where birds will try to find a little bit of the fat and protein. But apparently they've made kind of a shift from what is not naturally occurring, at least not in abundance in nature, to something that we offer for them. And I guess maybe it's similar to hummingbirds. Sure, sugar water is close to nectar, but why is it that hummingbirds have learned to zero in so well on a feeder rather than a clump of flowers? I think we've trained them a little bit. That they've learned to recognize that as a food source, and they've shifted their diet a little bit to what we offer them. So I think it's just simply that they've accommodated themselves to what we've made available.
Really interesting. Thanks, Mary. Appreciate it.
Yeah, good question.
Peter in Washburn, it's your turn. Hi, Peter.
Hello. Like she said, very timely. Just this morning, I had a bird maybe only 15 feet away, hopping outside the picture window. Anyway, so I saw all sides of it, and the only thing I can find in the Keys is a Kirkland's warbler, which is obviously very rare. Is it possible that that's what it was, or is there something else?
Yeah, we're a little early for Kirkland's warbler. They They tend to arrive later in the month. Their primary population is nesting in Michigan. They are attracted to the jack pine stands, and as the conservation efforts have been so successful over the decades to increase the population, they're spilling over into Wisconsin. We now have a nesting population in Adams County, Marquette County, and a few have shown up in scattered sites across northern Wisconsin, sometimes red pine, but usually more associated with younger age jack pine. As I say, this is a little early yet for most of the warblers, but there is one warbler in particular that is out of sync with all the others. It comes much earlier, 2 to 3 weeks before the real beginning of a warbler migration, and that is the yellow-rumped warbler. Check your book under yellow-rumped, or what used to be called the myrtle warbler. That is a bird that is here now. They're starting to arrive, and is one of the most abundant of our warblers. So we get a little bit of south wind here in southern Wisconsin. We'll start to see those numbers really increase, and they'll be making their way more into the central and northern part of the state over the next, say, 10 days or so. And we do have nesting of yellow-rumped warblers across northern Wisconsin and into Canada. But that is a bird I would certainly expect. I was out this morning, walked around by my house. I had a little group of about three, four yellow rumps together, and I saw them in a few different corners around the neighborhood here. So they're certainly present. That's the most likely one.
Peter, thank you so much for calling. Mm-hmm. Appreciate it. Had a great photo Bob in Wausau sent of tundra swans flying in the V formation, flying west. And there are five other birds in the formation that are not tundra swans.
Yeah.
He thinks they might be some case of geese. I don't know. Have you seen the photo, Bill?
Jill tried to forward to me. I didn't get the picture here with the attachment, but I was reading the email. And it's not too unusual, at least for a short distance, that geese may join in with something like that. What they're doing is they're, of course, drafting off of the birds. They're cutting the wind and creating a nice opportunity to be able to reduce their energy in flying. And I've seen, for example, some of the larger ducks even get in with Canada goose flocks. But they've got to be a bird, I think, kind of equal to their size or close to it anyhow for that effective drafting and to be able to keep up with them. So it's not common, but I think for short flights, certainly around Horicon Marsh, I've seen a little bit of a mixed flock where somebody will just join in because they're going their way, you know, get in there and take advantage of that drafting to cut the wind. But they're not going to migrate together for any great distance. I think it's more of a local movement. And so, yeah, just taking advantage of that.
Let's go to Joyce in Mount Horeb next. Hi, Joyce.
Hi, Larry. I thought I should tell you and Bill that I have a pair of phoebes that started building a nest yesterday under my deck. And first of all, I explained to them they're not supposed to be here yet because the insects aren't ready, and they seem to ignore me.
Well, the phoebe is a flycatcher, so it is an insectivore, but it's also a very early migrant. It is here, again, out of sync with the other flycatchers in the same way that the yellow rump comes here preceding by several weeks, the main wave of warblers. But both of those species tend to winter in the southern United States, where all the other flycatchers and warblers are really spending the winter in central and even northern South America. So they've got a much longer flight. So these birds can arrive much earlier than the big wave of songbirds. And it's actually not that unusual around mid-April to have phoebe coming. I've been hearing one around my house now for just over a week that he's been calling. And, yeah, they are looking for insects. And believe it or not, there are some insects out there. The problem for some of these early migrants, and this is true also of tree swallows, which are starting to arrive at this time, if we get a late storm, it can be quite devastating for them. And 2 years ago, we had exactly that happen. We had an April snowstorm that dumped a lot of snow across Wisconsin, and some of these birds were here already. I had a pair of phoebes that nested by my house for, oh gosh, probably 10 years in a row. It wiped out that pair and probably several others in the neighborhood. I'm happy to hear one back again this spring. So I had no nesting for 2 years. So it may seem a little early for us, and it is a little risky for these birds, but this is not unusual for them. And they like to nest like a robin on a little platform, a little overhang. Under bridges is not uncommon, say on an I-beam or by the eaves of a house. So and they'll make their nest, by the way, out of mosses that they'll gather into a nice little ball.
So there you go, Joyce. Thank you so much for calling. Kevin in Lodi, your turn. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Larry. Actually, my name, I pronounce it Kevin, but that's okay. Kevin. I have a craziest thing that happened to me on Monday. We're talking about birds. Well, I have an abandoned 2.5-story wood stove chimney that I don't have a wood stove there anymore. And it goes, it's in my family room, and I wasn't sleeping well, so I decided to go downstairs and sleep. Well, a wood duck female fell down that 2.5-story chimney, was able to open up the inspection door, and she just raised holy Hannah throughout the house.
Flying around the living room? Oh, no.
I mean, I didn't know if thought it was a nesting spot, or, I mean, I would.
That's exactly what she was doing.
Up there and fall down.
Right. They're inspecting right now, looking for cavities as potential nest sites. So whether it's a wood duck box or a natural cavity within a tree, they're searching those out and inspecting. The problem with a chimney is you take one step into it, and there's no way to get any footing or to be able to reverse yourself and get back out. And I know a number of people who've said over the years that they have cleaned out their chimney, say, coming before wintertime and find wood duck feathers in it or even occasionally an owl. Best thing to do is if you're not using that chimney is to cap that off so that the birds are not getting in there. The problem is we also want to make sure we don't cap all the chimneys because chimney swifts are dependent on the chimneys, especially the old chimneys, the brick ones, where they can cling to the side and build a nest. But, yeah, if it's becoming a bit of a hazard, you may want to just cap that.
All right. There you go, Kevin. Thank you so much.
I can imagine
that must have been
around the living room.
Oh, man. Oh, John in Sun Prairie has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, John.
Yeah, good morning. I'm glad you could help me get outside. About a year ago, we were in Cherokee Marsh and with another couple, and one of them had heard that the indigo buntings were in the area. I wondered when they'd be coming through this spring, how long they're around, and then where do they go to summer after this?
Okay, good question. Indigo bunting is a member of the cardinal family. And it is a true tropical migrant. They're spending their winter in Central America. It nests all across Wisconsin, but they won't arrive here until we get into May, usually around that, the 10th of May or so, or after the first week of May. That's usually when I start to see them arrive. And the indigo bunting, of course, is named for that brilliant deep blue color, but the blue is an iridescence. So if they're sitting at eye level and the sun's reflecting off them, it's a striking color. But as we get to the nesting season, the males move up into the treetops or sometimes onto the power lines, and they'll be singing from up there. And when the sun's coming off their back, they'll look black. So they're really quite a sight, and they're easily attracted to feeders when they first arrive and are desperate for food. But then once natural food becomes common, they'll tend, for the most part, not to visit feeders. We may occasionally have some that will take advantage of feeders throughout the summer, but it's usually a bird that will hit a feeder, say, that first week when they first arrive. And I've heard this so many times, where do all those indigo buntings go? They come to my feeder, they're there for a week or 10 days, and they all seem to disappear. They're just moving up into the treetops. And if you know the song of them, you'll find they're not really that uncommon. Anywhere you've got forest edges, they're a very common and very loud singing bird. Yeah, there you go. It's always very bubbly, two notes. They're paired notes, and they seem to go up and down. So you hear the two notes, kind of a up and down, very bubbly, a very characteristic voice quality to the voice. So once you get an ear for it, they're easy to pick out. And I would really recommend people get to know that song because once they leave the feeders, you don't see them that easily.
Yeah. Tyler, have you got that up again? Can we play that once more? Pretty. pretty
yeah,
solid.
Very rapid paired notes. And yeah, John, the leaves come out, they seem to disappear from view.
Thanks, John, for calling. Appreciate it. Cheryl in Esmer, Michigan, your turn. Hi.
Hi. Here's another bunting question. Anyways, last summer, I have woods on two sides of me and winding paths in there and stuff. Anyways, there was this little bird. Someone told me it was a bunting, but it had, like, psychedelic colors on its on the top of its wings, you know, like on the shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
But it was black, and a lady told me that she had them in her woods, too, and it was a bunting. But I couldn't find anything in a book.
Okay, well, as I said, indigo bunting, that blue is an iridescent color. So when the light is striking it, they really glow in that deep blue. But if the light is not reflecting off the bird, it may look almost black. So it's a reflected color. It's not an actual pigment within the feathers. Now, there is another bunting that has shown up in Wisconsin on occasion, and that is the painted bunting. It's nests in the southeastern part of the United States, but we've had a few sightings in Wisconsin. If you talk about psychedelic colors, it's a bird with just incredible colors of deep blue, red, and lime green. And the name painted bunting is really certainly quite appropriate. It's quite a rainbow.
Love seeing those buntings. Love seeing those buntings.
Great family. Mm-hmm. Great family.
Cheryl, thank you. Yeah, thank you so much. Anna in Madison, your turn.
Oh, hi.
Anna.
How are you?
Good. Appreciate the call.
I'm sorry?
I just appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I have a bird call that I recorded back in February on the 11th, and I've tried to get friends who know birds to identify it, and nobody can. Do you want to hear it?
Sure, why not?
Try, sure.
Okay, the thing is it starts out with a little bit of some wind chimes, and then it goes into the call, and I'm getting it back up again. Here it is. And so, did you hear it?
Yes, someone was a little muffled here coming through the phone for me. Sharp.
Can I try it again?
Well, my guess is maybe this is it sounds to me somewhat reminiscent of the tufted titmouse.
Oh.
And tufted titmouse. They've got a more musical actual song. This is a little bit more, you said February, a little more the contact calls at that time. They're not yet setting up territories or luring mates. But it is a very clear whistle, very sharp, clear whistle. And from what I heard of it, that's what it sounds like to me. Tufted titmouse is a close relative to the chickadee. Wisconsin's at the northern edge of its range. We've got them across the southern part of the state, especially Madison area, out to the La Crosse area. They're moving their way slowly north. I've had some in the northern Kettle Moraine, Green Lake County. I know they're in Marquette. They've been established for quite a long time. And a few birds show up north of that line, say from Milwaukee to La Crosse or just south of Eau Claire area. So they can show up a little bit here and there, but we're kind of at the far northern edge of their range. It is a permanent resident, so it's a non-migratory bird for the most part.
That's what it sounded like to me. Anna, go online. You can listen. You can find the calls and give a listen, but I think that's what you're going to find, a tufted titmouse.
Yeah, try
Thank
a couple
you.
Of the call notes. Yeah, allaboutbirds.com, the Cornell site. That's a real good reference for you. Check that out.
There we go. Thanks.
Yep, there
it is. Thanks, Anna. Thank you so much.
Yeah, the full song, the rhythm for the bird watchers is Peter, Peter, Peter. So the two notes very rapidly repeated and a nice, sharp, clear whistle like that.
All right, there we go. Thank you again, Anna. Adrian and Cable, your turn. Hi, Adrian.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Bill. How you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Yeah, I'm one of those weird people that hangs deer rib cages up in the trees. So
I want
to tell you a little bit about my experience there because I'm in a rural area where I can get away with it and I don't offend the neighbors by doing so. But they're just terrific as far as the woodpeckers and chickadees and nuthatches and crows. But in our case, too, we've had short-tailed weasels and bobcats in our rib cages. So even our mammal observation opportunities.
Yeah, great. Well, my suggestion would be for landscaping is put it in the backyard, not right out in front.
My thought on that is that when we had more natural ecosystems, we had large carnivores such as wolves and cougars that were regularly killing ungulates on a year-round basis scattered across their territories. And those ungulates, dead ungulates, provided food for a lot of different wildlife species, including many of our birds. And I suspect the fact that we don't have large carnivores living across the state is why we have sort of the deficit in that kind of food available for some of our birds.
Yeah, so a pretty good possibility. I mean, it's certainly well known that following, say, a wolf kill, that the ravens will come in and even the crows as scavengers. But something more solitary as woodpeckers or nuthatches coming in and picking away, I'm sure that that wasn't unusual for them to take advantage of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Adrian, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Joanne in Iowa County emailed that her friend made a screech owl house. How high does it need to be and tips to attract?
Okay, I've actually seen screech owls hanging out in wood duck boxes, and when I've cleaned out my wood duck boxes, on occasion I've found the pellets, the regurgitated hairballs after they've swallowed their food. So they do use those as winter shelter, and if they're not occupied by other birds, they may use something like that even for nesting. So wood duck boxes usually are only about, say, 5-6 feet off the ground. I would say for a screech owl, if you were to put it anywhere between about, say, 8 and 15 feet, that's probably suitable enough. You can put it higher, but it just becomes that much more challenging for people to get them up there and then to monitor anything. There are a lot of plans of birdhouse for construction, if anybody's looking for a woodworking project, and they usually include information of suitable habitat and height where to hang them. So you can check that online, too. I know the Northern Prairie States, there was a website that they had just a whole host of wildlife structure plans, anything from great blue heron and eagle platforms to a wren house.
Got about 30 seconds left. Ken and Elkhorn wondered if kingfishers can fly upside down.
They'll do a little kind of almost a barrel roll, so to speak, because they're twisting and turning occasionally. They're flying truly upside down. That's pretty rare for birds. We'll see eagles and some of the birds of prey in display flip upside down very shortly, but they're not built for flying that way. So, most of them, no. Now, they will twist and turn quite sharp, but to go completely upside down would not be practical for them.
Well, Bill, it's always a pleasure, a lot of fun. Thank you so much for being with us to talk with us today, and I look forward to your next visit. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Larry. Hope we can do it in person again soon in the future.
Bill Volkert, our guest, retired wildlife educator and naturalist, worked at Horican Marsh for 27 years. His book is called Journey of a Thousand Lifers. You can get it at BillVolkert.com. At his website. Tomorrow at 11, we'll be talking about home improvement with John Freiberger. He has a spring weather checklist he'll share with us, and looking forward to that. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening. Please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mehler.